Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 29 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Potato Head Gibby. Gibby, what is going on?
Nice. Wow, Potato Head.
Just came out today.
Yeah.
Facebook Potato Head.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for that.
All right, so we're back with Arthur Shawcross Part 2, and it's just going to get worse.
Oh, Part 2 is... Oh, man. Part 1 was nothing. Part 2 is going to tear you up.
All right, so got to start out with some of our supporters. Now, on Patreon, we had Donna Almeida, Jessica Lash Vixen. Pretty cool name.
That is a good name.
Right up there with Joe DeVee.
Yeah.
And we have Carol C. And then on PayPal, we actually had three people support us on PayPal, which
awesome.
Is really cool. We had the Wild Vine Soapery.
Okay. Like that.
I don't know what it is, but I'm going to check it out and get me some soap.
Yeah.
We had Michael Leonti and Jim Horton.
That's cool. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for all the support. We appreciate it. You know, as always, check out our website, truecrimeallthetime.com, contact info, merchandise info. Tell a friend about the podcast. That's a big thing, and I forget to mention it a lot, but, you know, word of mouth is huge for us. And also, you know, rate and review us. If you use iTunes, rate and review us there. If you have the opportunity on any of your Android apps, rate and review us there. All of that stuff helps. It gets the word out, helps us climb the charts, all good stuff.
Yeah, and listen to Unsolved.
Yeah, that's a good point, Gibbs. I mean, as soon as you're done listening to this episode, just jump right over. There's going to be a brand new True Crime All the Time Unsolved sitting there just waiting for you.
That's right.
To partake.
And you're going to enjoy it.
You will enjoy it, says Gibby. Gibby puts his Gibby stamp of approval
That's
on
right.
it.
It's been Gibby-nized.
That makes it good.
Gibby-nized.
Hey, folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime, and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. All right, so Arthur Shawcross, part two. Let's do a little recap. The Genesee River Killer, Monster of the Rivers, Rochester Strangler.
Bad, bad, and bad.
Bad, bad man.
Yep.
Bad enough to get three horrible nicknames.
That's right.
And just, you know, like we talked about last week, 1972, Shawcross kills two young, innocent kids, and he goes to prison, but he's only charged with the one, the boy, Blake.
Yeah.
Jack Blake. And they let him out. Pisses off the whole town, as it should, because he got a light sentence anyway.
Yeah, especially for what he did to the boy.
Yeah, he should have got a murder, and he got manslaughter.
Right.
First-degree manslaughter. So because of that, he gets paroled in 87. And as we talked about ending the last episode, you know, he had met this girlfriend, Rose Wally. They weren't welcome in any of these little New York towns that they were trying to settle in. As soon as they figured out that Arthur Shawcross was there, they were coming for him with the pitchforks.
Yeah. Would you want him in your neighborhood?
Hell no.
That's right.
And, you know, it started this relationship with a 56-year-old woman named Clara Neal. It was said that he just started the relationship because he wanted to borrow her car. And that's what he explained to Rose, because Rose kind of knew that he was having this other relationship. And he said, yeah, but I have to have it because this lady lets me borrow her car.
Yeah, I love you, baby. I'm just seeing her for the car.
Yeah, got to have my ride.
What if that, I don't think that worked today.
I don't think that would fly.
No.
But for some reason, Gibbs, I think this guy's much more suave than you and I.
You wouldn't think it by looking at him.
No, not by looking at him.
He knows how to say the right thing.
He seems to get around quite a bit.
Yeah.
And not have very much trouble.
Maybe they like his voice.
All right, so let's get into it. We're up to 1988. And the reason why we mentioned Clara, we had to, because part two starts off with Arthur riding his bike over to Clara's. Now, this is a grown-ass man.
So you think like a 10-speed, or you think was like one of those old chopper pedal bicycles
with,
you know,
the banana seat?
Yeah, banana seat and the little
ape hangers.
Yeah,
maybe he had some ape hangers.
Maybe that's
too
what he was doing.
So he rides his bike over to Clara's house to borrow her car. He's trolling around Lake Avenue in Clara's car, and this is like an industrial area, very well known for prostitution, drug dealing, all of those types of things. And he picks up a 27-year-old woman named Dorothy Blackburn. She signals him to stop, and he pulls over. And as you would see in a movie, I guess, Gibbs, she asks him, do you want a date? That's something stereotypical that you would see in a movie.
That's what I've heard.
With no firsthand knowledge.
That's right.
So he agrees, and she gets in the car, and they park behind this warehouse. And we touched on this a little bit in part one. All he wanted was to have oral sex. Mutual, both ways.
Okay.
I mean, this is his thing. He's not into regular intercourse.
Right.
Penetration. Because as we said, it's well known that he has trouble getting and maintaining erection.
And he missed his aunt.
He might have.
Yeah.
So they agree upon a price, as you would do, I'm told. So Dorothy gets undressed. And it was said, Gibbs, that she specialized in oral sex. You know, obviously, she was a prostitute and she was also a drug addict, but it specifically talked about that she specialized in oral sex. I don't know if that's what it said on her business card.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure.
The flyers she handed out.
The flyers. It was also said that she, and keep in mind, this is 1988. This is AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
The height of kind of misinformation, I think. I don't know the exact years, but
yeah, it was around that time.
I'm thinking
sure.
The late
yeah.
80s was that time. And she mistakenly thought that you could not get AIDS from having oral sex.
Oh, she wasn't aware of all that.
No. And
dental dam and stuff like that.
Right. So that's why she specialized in oral sex, because she had this mistaken thought that that's what would keep her safe from AIDS.
Probably wasn't alone in that world.
There was so much misinformation back then.
Right.
Now, as we talk about, and as we will talk about as we move forward, a lot of this comes from Arthur Shawcross later on after he starts blabbing.
Yeah.
So, again, you have to take some of this with a grain of salt. Did it happen? Did it not? But what Shawcross would describe is that Dorothy bites his penis.
Good for her.
Well, maybe. I don't know that she's in trouble yet, but
yeah. Well, that's true.
But good for her anyway.
Yeah.
But he becomes enraged, and he bites her vagina. I don't know if this was simultaneous. I don't know if it was a...
What do they call that?
I don't know if this was a...
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that number?
69 type action.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But it had to have been if...
I'm guessing.
He was able to, you know, retaliate in such a fashion.
So do you think it was foreplay? You bite me, I bite you?
I think it was much more than foreplay, if you believe Arthur Shawcross, because she drew blood.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not calling that foreplay.
No, I wouldn't either.
But again, I'm not sure that any of what he says is true.
Right.
But to tell the story, you have to tell
absolutely
some of his version of it. Yeah. You just have to. But what he does say is that he squeezes her throat and she loses consciousness. And at one point, he talks about having to tie something around his penis to stop the, almost like a tourniquet. If it's true, it must have been a
Not a nibble.
Yeah, it must have been a little chunk or something.
Yeah. Huh. That's going to leave a scar.
And then he proceeds to tie Dorothy up with her own clothing. He drives her out on a state route in Northampton Park around the Salmon River. And this is going to come up kind of along the way because this is one of his favorite fishing spots. Because if you remember back in the 70s when he got busted for killing the children, he was fishing all the time.
Yeah.
Well, he's back to his old ways.
He's back in the...
Yeah. Yep. He's got these fishing spots. But so far, that's all that's happened. He's tied her up. I say all, right? I'm not diminishing it.
No.
And at one point, they're stopping around this fishing spot of his. He tells Dorothy he's going to rape her. And she starts taunting him and calling him names.
That always...
goes over well.
Yeah.
This is going to come up a lot, Gibbs. And I'm going to have a lot to say about it. Because these are some of the things that I have a real hard time believing as Arthur describes how people react to him in these very dangerous situations that they know they're in at this point. He says he threatened to kill her, but she still continued to call him names. Now she's bound. He's saying, if you don't stop calling me names, I'm going to kill you. But apparently she does not stop, according to Arthur Shawcross. And he strangles her with his bare hands. And he sits in the car with her body, her dead body, until around midnight. And then he basically opens up the door, carries her out, walks calmly through the snow, and drops her body in the river. And then he says he drove back to Rochester, kind of drove around that area again. Then he went into a coffee shop and had some coffee and just relaxed.
Called it a day.
Yeah. You know, he's got to unwind.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Got to come down from something like that.
So after he's done with his coffee, Gibbs, he goes back to the car. Now, again, this is Clara's car, right? He doesn't own a car. He cleans out the car of any of Dorothy's property, any evidence, and he throws it into a trash can. And then the next morning, he returns the car to Clara. And he rides his banana seat ape hanger bike back home.
Back home. Wonder if he had one of those.
Maybe had the little bell that you flick with your thumb.
Yeah, or paperclip the playing card to your spokes, you know, yeah. So you went and we made that noise.
I can just picture this serial killer riding this bike.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it wasn't anywhere close to the bike that you and I are imagining, but still.
Yeah. Maybe it was like the bike Dorothy had Toto in. Little basket, cute little girl bike.
So he sees Clara the next morning as he returns the car, and then he goes home to Rose. And it was said later on that neither of the women noticed anything different about him, but mostly that was because he was always normally erratic, right? So he was normally acting strangely all the time. So it was just nothing out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Unlike you and I, who are totally normal.
Right, yeah.
Well, not total, but fairly normal.
Me, yeah.
And I just feel like if we did something like this, it'd be hard to hide in our actions or our demeanor.
I think it would be.
But for him...
Because that's how he always acted? Yeah. You didn't know.
He was acting so erratic all the time anyway. To them, there was no difference. Now, in the months after Arthur murdered Dorothy, and remember, this is his first kill in quite a long time. Right? Because he'd been in prison, he'd gotten out, and now he's on the prowl. And so in the months after that, he starts trolling this Lake Avenue area that we mentioned that was, you know, ripe with prostitution and drug dealing, always kind of borrowing Clara's car at night and trolling this area, so much so that he becomes known to the local prostitutes in the area, and they know him as Mitch. I'm assuming, Gibbs, that as he's conducting business, he's introducing himself as Mitch.
Yeah, it's a good name to go by.
If you have to pick a name.
Yeah. Hey, ladies, I'm Mitch.
Now, the police find Dorothy's body on March 24th, and they find it floating in the river downstream from where he had dumped her body. Had floated some ways. Now, unlike a lot of bodies that we talk about, Gibbs, her body was very well preserved. because of the time of year. Because
it was cold.
The water was very cold. Even though her body was well preserved by the water had also pretty much washed away any usable evidence.
Right.
The one gruesome detail about Dorothy's body was that when it was found, there was a large part or almost a chunk that had been torn out of her vagina. So you can only imagine the police officers that found this body. I mean, what must they have been thinking? Not only has this woman been killed, she's been dumped in the water. Her genital area has been mutilated. That's something very specific.
Oh, absolutely.
That's not a drive-by shooting.
No.
Somebody took great detail or they took extra effort to do something like that.
Definitely took extra effort.
So now for a few months after that, Arthur was somehow able to control his frog demon. Because I'm just assuming he has a frog demon. He has something.
Maybe more than one.
We like to call it a frog demon. It's at this point, though, several months after he had killed Dorothy, he's working at this produce plant. And his boss finds out about his criminal past. And I'm not sure, you know, why it was so hard or why it took him so long. But he gets fired. And this is April of 88. And this really kind of starts to send him down a spiral. Although he does get another job at a place called G&G Food Service. And it was said that he was a salad maker. Not one of your tougher jobs. I'm not putting down anybody if you are a salad maker.
So he knew how to toss a salad.
Well, he had been in prison for quite a long time. You know, I can make a salad, so nobody pays me $6.25 an hour for that. It is known, though, Gibbs, that during this period, he continues to frequent the prostitutes of the Lake Avenue area. But he doesn't kill anybody during this time.
He's just good old sweet Mitch, huh?
Yeah, he's just Mitch trying to meet his needs, although he has two girlfriends at the time. All right, Gibbs, so Shawcross's second victim was a 27-year-old named Anna Steffen. Arthur picked her up and took her to the Genesee River Gorge near this bridge called the Driving Park Bridge, which is a very strange name for a bridge. Now, we're talking July 8th, 1989. So you have to figure that he did go quite a period of time between his first and second victim.
That we know of.
Yeah. He confessed to, let's say that.
Yeah. Okay.
And we talked about it, you know, he's visiting all these prostitutes, but he's not killing them during this kind of long stretch, long for him, let's put it. Now, according to Arthur, they struck a deal for sex for $20. But after 40 minutes, he was unable to get an erection, right? Common theme. We keep talking about that. This is a problem that he has. And she begins to make fun of him, if you believe what he's saying.
And we know how well that worked out for the last victim.
Well, it's not going to work out for any of them. I can tell you that. I don't want to foreshadow or, you know, give too much away. The other thing that Arthur says, and this is, again, things that I have trouble with. He claims that Steffen told him that she had seen him with Dorothy Blackburn and that she was going to tell the police about it. You're in a secluded area with a guy that you saw with the person that was murdered, and you're going to tell the police that you knew it, but yet you're going to go with this guy to a secluded area, you're going to make fun of him about not being able to get an erection, and then you're going to threaten him with the fact that you're going to tell the police
for $20.
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't
at all.
Makes zero sense to me.
So he becomes angry, starts beating her up, punching her. She's trying to get away from him. And she makes it to the water. He goes in after her and he just holds her head down in the river by her throat and drowns her. He would later tell the police that he didn't even try to hide her body. He just pushed it out into the water and let it float downstream. And her body did float, but ultimately get caught up in some debris. And it was discovered on September 9th, but she had been killed in July. So much warmer than when he had killed Dorothy. and her body was in a pretty serious state of decomposition, unlike Dorothy's.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Didn't have that icy cold water to help preserve the body.
I met Anne-Marie Steffens, I think, in front of the Finger Hut on Lake Avenue.
Do you remember killing her?
Yeah, possibly. We're not going into details here.
No, but how did you kill her?
Probably strangulation.
How do you know when they're dead?
How? I don't know, just do. More or less after they just relax. The body relax, doesn't fight no more. It only takes about 4 minutes, probably.
So we're not going to go into details, Gibbs. So to get around that, I'm just going to say probably in front of everything.
Right.
How'd you do it? Probably strangled her.
Probably only took 4 minutes.
Probably. True Crime All the Time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. You know, my wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. So now we get to his third victim. And the third victim was a little different from the first two. Because she wasn't a prostitute. She was actually a 59-year-old homeless woman named Dorothy Keller. Arthur met Dorothy when she was working at a waitress in this diner that he went into a lot. And they actually struck up a friendship. And somehow it turned into an affair. I'm telling you, Gibbs, this guy's getting more than anybody I know.
Yeah, he's...
And he looks like somebody hit him in the face with a frying pan. So
some women like that, though.
He's got to be a smooth talker.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. Now, Dorothy also worked for Arthur and Rose sometimes as kind of a part-time housekeeper. So she would come in, clean up, and Arthur would pay her, you know, some money. And one afternoon, Arthur runs into Dorothy Keller as he's on his way to fish. This guy liked to fish. He liked women and he liked to fish. Those two things I know. And she wanted to go fishing with him when he said he was going fishing. So as Arthur tells it, they spent the morning fishing and making love, which is a pretty normal combination.
Yeah.
The fishing, making love.
A little weird for him since he typically doesn't like intercourse, but.
Well, that is true. And then he says it started to rain at some point. And so they got under this shelter and were kind of sitting there talking and somehow got into a fight. And he started saying and accusing her of stealing money from his house while she was doing these part-time housekeeping. The other thing that he said is that she threatened, and again, this is something that he says a lot. Somebody's always threatening to tell on him about something. So she threatened to tell Clara about Rose and Rose about Clara, which my understanding was Rose already kind of knew about Clara.
Right.
But either way, he got upset. He found this log and he beat her in the head until she died. Now, he hides her body under a fallen tree and he goes home. Now, much later, after he's caught, he would tell the police that he returned to that spot several months later. He removed her skull and he dumped it in the river. This is another thing we're going to see from Arthur Shawcross a lot. He has this need to return to the scene of the where he dumps these bodies. It's almost like a compulsion.
She used to live in my house or my apartment for a while.
Was she a friend?
She was, until she started stealing stuff out of the house. I asked her, why are you stealing? She said, I needed money. And I said, you have a bank account. I was paying her $4.25 an hour just to clean the apartment.
So she was thieving from you?
She was taking from me and my wife, Rose.
Does that warrant killing her?
Huh?
Does that warrant killing her?
Well, to me it did.
After you killed her, you went back later to see the body. Is that right?
No, I went back to clean up.
She was found with her head removed. Did you?
That's right.
How did that happen?
Easy. You just pick it up and move it.
What, you just pull the head off?
Yeah, it was already off.
You just pick it up and move it.
That's simple as that.
Just don't buy anything he's saying.
I think he's one of those folks that there's a mixture of truth and lies.
Well, yeah, because obviously some of the stuff he says is true.
Right.
I think he did go back to the body. He did pick up the skull and he did throw it in the river. But he says that he went back to the body to clean up. So to your point, there's part truth and then there's some lies to make himself maybe look a little better. Because we're going to find out as we go along that he goes back to these bodies to do some other things.
Well, I mean, we knew he went back to the kids. You know, he went back to the boy.
Right.
Several times to the murder site and had sex with them.
Yeah, and he's going to do that moving forward. And I think cleaning up is a euphemism for him probably doing something that he doesn't want to talk about.
Right.
That's what I think. Now, fishermen, they would eventually find Dorothy Keller's body. But at this point, Shawcross is not connected with any of these women. I mean, he is connected. I mean, the police haven't connected him. Even though, and especially with Dorothy, he had been seen with her a lot. Like he said, she lived in his house for a while. He was in the diner a lot. She was over at his house cleaning. And the other fact was he often went to that fishing spot where he left her body. There's going to be a lot of things as we go through this that, looking back, you would think maybe the police could have picked up on. I mean, you can always do that, right? You can always play kind of second guess armchair quarterback. But there are some stuff here as we go through that just make me think, man, if they could have just connected this one dot, they really could have stopped this guy
a whole lot earlier.
You're right. Now, in August of 89, Arthur and Rose get married. They've been living together for a couple of years. And really, the only reason I bring it up is because the one thing that I found very interesting was that it was said that Arthur had invited a lot of people to the reception. Now, I don't know how many people he knew or how many people wanted to know him. So I don't know how he came up with this guest list. But the funny part about it was to me that he had made lots of food and bought, you know, everything for this kind of big reception. And there was only two people that showed up. And it was the boyfriend of Rose's daughter and the boyfriend's mother. Those are the only two people showed up. And I just had this kind of thought in my head of him standing there with this huge spread of food waiting, you know, for all these people to come eat. And there's two people standing there. But why is there only two people? Because nobody likes this son of a bitch.
Nope.
Right? Everybody in all these other towns, they've driven him out. This guy can't have any friends at this point. I don't know why he thought that all these people were going to show up to his wedding. I don't know. I was just really...
Maybe he thought all the girls down on Lake Avenue were going to show up too.
But then they would know he wasn't Mitch.
Well, that's true.
He can't invite them. That would give him away.
That'd give it away, yeah.
So he's married now, but he's still kind of carrying on with Clara to use her car. And Arthur would go down to Lake Avenue one night, and he would pick up a 25-year-old named Patty Ives. And a lot of these will sound familiar. They agreed on a price of $25 for sex, and they end up going to this construction site, and they lay down on this dirt patch. Doesn't sound like the best scenario. Now, Arthur says they were having sex. Now, again, that's where I get suspicious, because by everything we've heard, he can't get an erection, get or maintain. But he's telling people after the fact that they were having sex. But as they were having sex, he caught Patty Ives trying to steal his wallet. And that pissed him off, right? So it's kind of the same thing if you think about it, Gibbs. It's approach the girl. We agreed on a price. We were doing X. And then something happened that caused me to get pissed off. Right. I mean, this is like a bad script that you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the same thing. It's just small variations. So he attacks her. She starts crying. And now he claims that he rapes her while strangling her until she was dead. Now, this goes back to what? The association between sex and pain.
Yeah.
That's the other element going back to his childhood.
Exactly.
Now, he would hide the body of Patty Ives under some construction material. He waits till dark, and then he goes home. Later on, as Shawcross is telling all these stories, recounting all of these things, he would say that Ives threatened him with the fact that she had seen him with Anna Steffens. Right? So, again, another part of a bad script that he's writing.
It just seems like he's trying to use it as a justification.
That's exactly what he's... It's just so much BS. Now, it's not strange to me that these women may have seen him with some of the women that end up being found dead. What's very strange to me, Gibbs, is that they would see him or have seen him, choose to go with him to this secluded place, knowing what they know or thinking what they think. And then on top of that, they're in a compromised situation.
They're going to agitate him?
And they're going to agitate him by threatening him to go to the police and say that, oh, by the way, I know that he was with so-and-so on or before the night they went missing.
Instead of just saying, I've got a problem, picked up a sex worker, raped her, strangled her, he wants to blame it on the victim.
That's victim blaming. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. He has to come up with a reason why he would have done what he did.
Yeah, she was a thief, and then she also threatened me. So I'm going to go ahead and strangle her.
Instead of just admitting that you're a piece of shit with this uncontrollable urge to do horrible things. All right, Gibbs, so that brings us up to October of 89. As you can see by the time frame, he's starting to ratchet up a little bit. He's unable to control his urges, and so his frequency is increasing big time. And Shawcross kills another prostitute named Frances Brown. And Frances Brown was 22 years old. But here again, we get into what I call the claims of Arthur Shawcross. And this one is pretty tough to believe. Not that it couldn't happen, but as Arthur tells it, he actually choked Frances Brown to death with his penis while having oral sex. But then he goes on to say that he continued to have sex with her body long after she had died.
Well, but I believe that.
No, I believe. I'm not saying he's not telling the truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm saying it's gruesome.
Oh,
no, you're getting into necrophilia. I mean, that's...
No, I know. That's terrible.
to be honest with you, in the scale of Arthur Shawcross, that's actually pretty low on the scale.
Yeah.
If you think about it, especially when we both know what is still to come.
Yeah.
And not to mention the fact of what he did to those kids. That was horrible.
And that's the only reason I can make lighter stuff, because it's the only way for me to get past some of this.
Well,
this is so terrible.
This was a very, you know, this was a tough one to research. There's no doubt about it. We've touched on some very gruesome stuff, but there is much more to come. So Shawcross dumps the body of Francis Brown down an embankment, and it was said by police that there was so much debris that was dragged down this embankment as her body tumbled down. They thought initially when they found the body that somebody had covered it on purpose, but somehow they later figured out that no, it just
from tumbling down that this happened.
And it just picked up so much debris with it. It was almost like she was covered. Now, it was after Brown's murder. This is really when the media starts to pick up on the story and starts to connect some of these murders of these Rochester women. Because we're talking about a period of 18 months so far from when Shawcross starts what I call his second act, right? So he's got out of prison. He starts killing again. It's been about 18 months from the first one to now. And this is when he starts to get the nicknames. So the newspapers are putting out their articles and they're calling him the Rochester Night Stalker, the Rochester Strangler, the Genesee River Killer. That's the one that I think he becomes known for most of all. There was even some talk, Gibbs, that the crimes were similar to the Green River killings in Seattle, enough that some people thought that maybe the Green River Killer had gone cross country to New York and had just changed locations. And they were attributing what Arthur Shawcross was doing to maybe being the Green River Killer.
Yeah.
Now, we know it wasn't.
No, but
the situation on the ground when I first arrived was a lot of stress, a massive police involvement in this thing. There's no doubt in their mind they had a serial killer working up there. One of the big questions was, well, how's he getting these women? These prostitutes are scared to death, and they're being killed. Yet, he seems to have no trouble getting them. The answer is, he's a regular client. They know him. They go with him. They have successful sex. He drives them back, drops them off, no problem. So they're not afraid to go with him. It's just some nights it goes terribly wrong.
We're trying to think, how can these prostitutes make these mistakes knowing that there is a perpetrator on the street that's snatching them right under police surveillance?
I think the prostitutes, and maybe to a degree, some of the investigators are looking for like a real weird guy or somebody really, really out of sync with what was going on, when in fact it was just the opposite. You wanted to look for somebody who really was very much attuned to that scene and very comfortable in that environment.
What I take away from that, Gibbs, is something that we already talked about, which is, why would these women go with Arthur Shawcross? And the reason is because he was a regular.
Yeah, he had a relationship with them already.
He did, but back to the point of them threatening him to out him to police, that's the part I don't buy. Because I think if they knew that, or they suspected that he was one of the last people to be seen with some of these women that had been murdered, they wouldn't have gone with him. That's why I don't buy that part at all.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, to me, it's just kind of, it's deranged.
Now, for his next victim, Shawcross mixes it up a little again. He actually chooses somebody that he knows. Now, this woman, June Stotts, she was actually a friend to both Arthur and Rose, and she was at their house quite a bit. Now, June was described as having some mild mental disabilities. And on October 30th, 1989, Shawcross ran into her near the river. June was sitting, you know, on the riverbank. It was a pretty warm November day, and he asked her to go for a ride with him. She accepted, and they ended up driving down to a local beach, and Shawcross says they played in the sand and they fed the birds. And then they walked to a deserted area. I mean, this is almost like a, you know, like a movie.
Yeah.
and then they laid down on the ground and they made love.
It's like The Notebook.
Yeah. He's like the star of The Notebook.
Yeah.
He's like a Ryan Gosling.
Waiting for the big kiss scene.
There were some differing stories about how all of this went down, though, from this point forward. There was one story I found where Shawcross claimed that as they were making love, he made a comment about the fact that she wasn't a virgin, and she got very upset, and she actually started screaming at him. And because of that, he put his hand over her mouth to keep her quiet, but at some point he realized he'd killed her by suffocation. A little unlikely.
Accidents happen.
Right, but you could breathe through your nose.
Yeah, he knew what he did.
He knew. So if that was the story, I don't know.
Yeah.
The second story, which is a little more believable to me, is that after they did have sex, he strangled her because she said to him that she was going to tell people that they had had sex.
Oh, I believe that.
And more. He didn't want that to happen.
Yeah.
He didn't want people to know that they had had sex.
But he was trying to keep her quiet.
Yes.
This is how he kept people quiet.
So of the two stories, I think that one is much more believable to me. But the next part is very gruesome. So that's my warning, right? I'm trying to do better on giving warnings.
Just put down the turkey sandwich?
Put down the pulled pork sandwich,
yeah,
for sure. And this is going to be a theme that we're going to see, unfortunately, because about a week later, Arthur returns to the body where he had, I don't even know if he'd hidden it that much, but enough to where nobody had found it during the week. He returns to the body. He has sex with the body again. And then he cuts the body open, cuts out the vagina, and he eats it. Now, Gibbs, this body has been sitting there for a week.
So you're worried about food poisoning?
I'm worried about losing my breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
I mean, that is disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just, man, it's unbelievable. It's just trying to get into this guy's head and how he thought.
Don't do it, man. Yeah. I'm afraid you'll never come back.
I probably won't. I mean, it's just terrible that he killed her. But then he's coming back a whole week later. I mean, it's in November, but it's still the body's got us.
Well, it said it was a warm November day.
Yeah, so body's kind of decomposing, probably bloated up a little bit.
A week is a long time.
And now he's having sex with it, and then he's going to cut it open, and then he's going to take the vagina out and
eat it.
Eat it?
It's bad enough that anybody would do that right after they killed somebody. It would be unbelievably horrific. But to wait a week, that to me is just almost inconceivable. I mean, I can't imagine what that must have been like.
Mm-mm.
Horrible.
That was a fit of anger. You know, we spent a day down at Turning Point Park, you know, feeding the ducks and walking around and we're making out. Then she just flipped. You know, jumped up, says, "I'm going to scream. I'm going to tell the cops." I snapped her neck. Stayed there all day until dark. Then split her open from her neck to her groin. I didn't go all the way deep into the stomach area. Just split her open. I don't know why.
This is what's strange about Arthur Shawcross is because there's so many stories that none of them match, right? So even when he tells it, it doesn't match another time that he told it. He snapped her neck. At one point, he strangles her. In the tape, he talks about waiting later that night and doing something to the body. But there's a lot of evidence that he waited much, much longer, like we said. So again, some of this is hard to pin down, but it doesn't matter.
No, it's all horrendous.
It's all horrific. And hopefully everybody is getting the full picture and the full gravity of what this guy really was.
Oh, I think we painted a nice picture.
And we might paint another picture, too.
That's true, too.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
But the one thing we know, Gibbs, is that he's continuing to pick up the pace. He picks up another woman, Maria Welch, 22 years old, on November 9th. So he's not, you know, it's like he's ratcheting up. And again, he picks her up from the Lake Avenue area. That's kind of his trolling place. And he takes her to a small beach area on the banks of the Genesee River. And I guess we're saying beach, but I guess it's like river, you know, like a river bank.
Well, you can have a beach area on any water
like
source.
Like a sandy, not like, when I think beach, I think ocean, but.
Yeah, well, you're.
I'm fancy like that.
Fancy like that.
And he says that they argue for a while. They're unable to agree on a price, so they argue over that, but they finally do agree on a price, and they begin having sex. And again, he claims that she tried to steal his wallet, and because of that, he strangles her. Now, later on down the road, at another time, he tells the story that to investigators that he got angry and killed her because she had told him she wasn't on her period, and he found out that she was. So which is it? Probably neither. I think he's picking up these women. He's taking them to a secluded area. And he is using these excuses as a reason to have killed them when there was no reason to kill them at all. Not that any of these would be reasons either. I think there was nothing that brought on the killing other than the fact that he needed to kill. So with Maria Welch's body, he puts her in the car, he drives down the road a bit, and he dumps it in the river near some bushes on the side of the river. Now, on November 13th, this is 4 days after he's killed Maria Welch, police find the body of Francis Brown. And it said, Gibbs, at this point, that there are 60 people working on this combined task force to find the killer. But what I find very strange is that they got 60 people working on this task force, and not one of them has managed to figure out that they've got a guy living in town that, number one, is a known sex offender and child killer and is living right in town on parole, still on parole. That just boggles me that they haven't been able to figure that part out and at least think, well, here's a guy we should look at.
So I think today, with a better technology, they probably would have put things together much faster than they did back then.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, the sex offender registry and all the automation or the databases and things that we have today, I think it would have helped them out. So on November 22nd, just a little over a week later, Shawcross encounters a woman named Joanne Van Nostrand. And I swear, Gibbs, that was some crazy character that Kramer played in Seinfeld.
By the way, I was thinking, why does that sound familiar?
I don't remember exactly what it was, but I swear.
Van Nostrand.
Van Nostrand.
Dr. Van Nostrand.
I don't know.
That's it.
But he meets this Joanne. Again, they agree upon a price. And it's said by Arthur that they have sex. And by his own admission, this is the first time that he was ever able to have sex and actually ejaculate with the prostitute. But the most interesting part about Joanne is that at some point she gets super leery of Arthur and she pulls a knife on him because alarm bells are going off in her head that he's acting strange and she's fearing for her life. And you have to believe, Gibbs, this is probably one of the best decisions that she has ever made or ever did or ever will make in her life, because she actually survives this monster by taking that action.
Wow.
Now, the very next day, November 23rd, police find the decomposed and mutilated body of June Stotts. Now, we know on the 22nd, Arthur didn't kill, but he probably had designs on killing. And so he can't wait very much longer because it's just 4 days after that, on the 26th, that he picks up a woman named Elizabeth Gibson. No relation.
No relation.
She gets into his car. And it's November. It's pretty cold out by now. It was said that she's in his car, kind of getting warm, and he's inside the diner getting some coffee. They agree upon a price, and they had oral sex in the car. But as he often does, Arthur uses the, "She tried to take my wallet." Everybody's trying to take this guy's wallet. And he gets angry, and he strangles her. Now, the one thing about Elizabeth is she fought hard. And during this altercation and the struggle and everything, she managed to gouge his face pretty severely, is the way I understood it. And I guess it was such a hard-fought struggle that Arthur even tells the police later on that she had broken the gear shift in his car. They were fighting so much as he was trying to strangle her. The other thing about this one, Gibbs, is that He strayed away from his normal body dumping plan because he actually goes to another county to dump the body of Elizabeth Gibson because he's thinking that the police are getting too close to him, which is actually very smart if you think about it from a killer's perspective. I hate to give killers credit, but the reason I'm saying that is because we're going to see he's not very smart moving forward. I don't know if it's the urge. I don't know what it is, but he is ratcheting up to a degree that it's like another week goes by, and on December 4th, he's already trolling again on Lake Avenue. And this time he picks up a woman named Darlene Trippy, and he drives her to an isolated location. The money is exchanged, and they have oral sex. But Arthur can't get an erection, and it's said that Darlene becomes very frustrated with Arthur and she starts calling him names. And because of that, he chokes her until she was dead. And he dumps her body in just an open woodland. So he doesn't, again, he doesn't go back to what his plan was of trying to go out and dump the body in another area because the police are getting too close.
Right.
But also we come back to, why are all these women calling him names and making fun of him? And I say they're not.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if in that situation,
you wouldn't, because you're so vulnerable, right? You're in a car. You're in an isolated, secluded spot. That is not the situation where you choose to antagonize somebody trapped in a little vehicle where nobody can hear or see you.
Yeah,
that makes no sense.
Doesn't make any sense.
Especially for it to happen repeatedly, time and time again.
Same with the wallet, you know?
I think that's just one of his go-to built-in excuses.
Maybe if everybody's trying to steal your wallet, maybe you need to put it somewhere else. It's not the case, though, but it's what he always says. They tried to steal my wallet. So what's he doing? Leaving it out in the open and they're hand is touching it and he thinks there's, I don't get it.
Now, could somebody try to steal your wallet in that situation? Sure. Would it happen 3 or 4 times and you just happen to kill him? It's laughing at Arthur Shawcross because it's laughable.
Yeah.
The things that he would say later on to try to justify what he did when there's no justification.
Well,
ever.
He wants to be this big, bad guy that does all these terrible things, but he can't be the big, bad guy that stands up and says, yeah, I just killed him because I wanted to kill him. He has to make it like, well, I wouldn't have killed him if they didn't try to take my wallet that had $100 in it.
Right.
Or I wouldn't have killed him if they didn't start calling me names.
There's a lot of Eileen Wuornos here. And, you know, the story of Eileen Wuornos is that, you know, she was a prostitute. Her story was that she killed because she was always, it's almost like the reverse of Eileen Wuornos. She was in the other she was on the other side of the car.
Yeah.
And she kept killing all these men, but she would always say it was, oh, I was in fear of my life. So it was almost like Eileen Wuornos meets Arthur Shawcross. The one thing we know, Gibbs, at this point, there's this huge task force and they're out looking for the killer. And they're actually out in force in the Lake Avenue area because they know that's where all these women have disappeared from. And Arthur Shawcross, you would think, would know this, right? If you're watching the news, if you're paying any kind of attention, you know that the police are out looking for this person. But it doesn't stop him at all. Because on December 26th, the day after Christmas, when you're supposed to be playing with your toys, your kids' toys, or celebrating with friends and family, that's not what Arthur's doing. He's out on Lake Avenue. And he picks up a woman named June Cicero, 34 years old. And again, I mean, I hate to sound like a broken record, but I have no choice because he takes her to an isolated area, you know, exchange money. And what he says is that he attempts to have sex with her before strangling her. Now, what he would go on to say is that she made fun of him because he could not get an erection. And he added, he doubled down. He also added she threatened to tell the police who he was. And again, that's the one that gets me the most. If she knows who he is, she would never have gotten in the car. If she had any inkling that he was the guy killing all of these women, that is the part that is it that he is living in some type of fantasy world? He has just made up all of these fantastical accounts so that he can say these were, I don't know what you call them, Gibbs, justified? Can't be justified. Accidental murders?
No, I know. I think he's doing exactly that. He's justifying it in his mind that I didn't do anything wrong. If she didn't pick on me and call me a name or touch my wallet or did this or
make fun of me,
she'd be here today.
But we know.
But she bullied me like those kids did in school.
Right. But we know more than likely that's not the case because what everybody knows about Arthur Shawcross is that he's a sadistic killer. And that he can only get off when either he is subjecting somebody to pain, one of his victims.
Well, that's who he needed to find then. Instead of just picking random women, he should have found somebody that specialized in delivering or receiving pain for sexual stimuli.
If you've got a fetish, there is somebody out there that you can pay to satisfy your needs for whatever fetish you have. There's somebody out there.
Allegedly.
No, I'm telling you there is.
Well, you probably know, so.
But you know that's true.
I know that you would know that's true, yes.
It can't be just that. I mean, it is the only way that he can get off. I do believe that. But it can't just be that. It has to be something more. It has to be the fact that he has an urge to kill as well.
Absolutely. I don't think he could do this if it was pre-planned, like, hey, I'm going to pay you X amount.
Let me do this.
I'm going to do this and you're going to scream. And no, it has to be that no one knows it's coming kind of a thing.
I agree with you because if he didn't have a need to kill, and I almost hate to say this, but he could have picked these women up and he could have inflicted some type of pain enough to satisfy his whatever this thing we're calling it is, but not have, and then just kicked him out of the car. He didn't have to kill them if all he needed was to merge the sexual aspect with the sadistic need to inflict pain. But he goes the extra step because he has to. It's not just that. It's a need to kill as well. That's what I believe. Now, Shawcross would take the body of June Cicero and he would dump it or throw it off of a bridge over the, I'm going salmon. I don't know if it's salmon or salmon.
Salmon swim like this.
You're doing something with your hand on an audio podcast.
Oh, well, you're the one that does the air quotes.
Yeah, but I don't say like this. All right, let's go salmon.
All right, salmon.
Somebody's going to tell us anyway, yeah. And we like that.
Well, we know he likes to fish, so He's up right by one of his fishing holes is what he.
And that's what he does.
Yeah.
I mean, he really does. He goes to, I mean, that's why he's on the Genesee River.
Yeah.
He knows it pretty well. He fishes there quite a bit. But one of the reasons why he does choose it, like we said, because he knows it, is because he revisits these bodies.
How did June Cicero die? How did you kill her?
Strangled her. Mostly my left hand.
Well, so you strangled them with just one hand?
Right there. Pressure point. It was snowing real bad one night. And I went out Route 19, I think it was, and I crossed over on 31, headed back toward the city. And there was no cars coming, and I just opened the door and pushed her out. She went over the bridge, over to knock some snow down, went down in the water. And he just closed the door and kept going.
I mean, how cold is that?
That's cold, man.
And what's the thing about, he's almost bragging that he was able to strangle her one-handed.
I didn't even have to take my hand off the wheel.
Like a badge of honor. Like,
yeah.
This is how good I was.
One-handed. I took care of that.
I mean, just listening to him, I know people are going to be, it's so matter of fact. And it's almost braggadocious. It almost drives me up a wall a little bit just listening to him. And I think the audience is going to get that too, right? You know all the details, and then you have to sit and listen to this guy smugly talk about this type of stuff.
And this is the difference between, like, we listened to BTK. This guy here got, like, some pride behind it.
Yeah, what BTK was more of almost like robotic.
Yeah, matter of fact.
This is what I did.
Yeah.
This guy, he's got a smugness, like a bragginess about him that
irks me, man.
Yeah,
what a jerk.
It really irks me. Now, a few days later, Shawcross would return to the dump site. He would take a small handsaw and he would cut out the vagina from the frozen body, and he would eat it. So Gibbs, I just don't know how you can get a whole lot more disgusting than what Arthur Shawcross has done. And keep in mind, we talk about what's fact versus what's fiction. We know this is a fact because police find the body. He's not making this up. We know it. So there might be some stuff that he said that is questionable, but you can't question this. It happened.
Yeah.
Now, what the police do different this time when they find the body is they don't publicize it as they have all the other victims. And the reason they don't is because they have a profile of the killer. And this profile is indicating that this killer likes to revisit the dump sites of the victims. And this new tactic that they're going with, they're going to leave the body where it is and they're going to stake out the area. And this is really going to pay off in a big way. But it's not going to pay off before Shawcross would claim his final victim. And that would be 29-year-old Felicia Stevens. Felicia, what made her different from all of the other victims of Arthur Shawcross was that she was African-American. And every other victim that had come before her was Caucasian. In this second chapter, as I call it, they've all been Caucasian females. And even in the first chapter of his killing career, the poor young children that he murdered,
right,
they were Caucasian as well. It doesn't mean anything. It's just an interesting fact. Because in later interviews, this is one murder he couldn't remember a lot of the details on, which is strange, right, Gibbs?
I mean, he remembered everything on all the other ones and then added his little flair.
And made up some stuff.
Right. But yet he can't recall any of this one.
The only thing that he could remember was that she was black and that he had strangled her and he had dumped her body very near the body of Jean Cicero and Dorothy Blackburn. That's the only thing. He didn't have, you know, this story about, she called me names and stole my wallet. And
so she didn't try to take the wallet? And
he didn't have any of that. Yeah. There was no there was no story about behind why he strangled her. And according to him, it was because he couldn't remember. I find that very hard to believe.
I find it extremely hard to believe.
Because it wasn't because it was so long ago. She was the very last victim. But we have to talk a little bit about the fact that he dumped a lot of these bodies very near each other. And it was said that he did that because he wanted to make it easier to find them when he did his thing of revisiting the bodies.
Yeah.
But ultimately, this is what's going to lead to him getting captured. And this is part of what doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I get it if he needs to do it because he wants to make sure he knows where the bodies are. But you remember we talked about that one victim where he was starting to understand that the police were closing in on him. And so he thought, you know, I need to go to a different county even to dump this body. But he kind of just did that the one time. And then he reverted back to dumping them, a lot of them, kind of close together. And the only thing I can figure out is that his need to revisit the bodies was just so strong that it overwhelmed his sense of
common sense,
his common sense, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And it actually comes into play very quickly because on January 3rd of 1990, he drives back to visit Gene Cicero's body. And my understanding, Gibbs, is that he was aroused by the thought of having sex with her dead body. But like we talked about earlier, apparently he wasn't watching television. He didn't know about the task force. So we got to talk about this, Gibbs, because people are going to put two and two together. How is he thinking he's going to have sex with this corpse when he's cut out the vagina?
I was sitting here thinking the same thing.
I mean, it's possible. I don't want to go into all the details of how it's possible, but it's very strange to me.
Clearly, he'll find his way to get his jollies off. Man, just how bizarre is that? I mean, more time has passed.
He's killed somebody in between.
In between, yeah.
Well, and the other thing is, he obviously has not been following either television or radio. He has to know that this task force is out there combing the area for him, because it was said that it was no secret that there was police surveillance in and around this area. Now, they hadn't publicized the fact that they found the body, right? So that's one reason why he thinks he can go back to the body. But there was publicity around the fact that there was increased police surveillance. Now, Arthur would later say that when he got to the bridge, he was happy because there was no cars parked where he wanted to stop at this very specific spot on the bridge. He could actually overlook the creek and view Gene's body while he ate his lunch. Can you believe that?
No, I can't. I mean, I'm sorry. This is just gross,
it,
man.
It defies belief.
I'm not laughing. I'm just...
It's almost like... gasp.
Yeah, it's like, you know, most people go eat their picnic lunch, you know, by the pond to look at the ducks, and he's having his lunch to go look down by the river at some
mutilated. Well, and here's the kicker. If you remember back, we talked about him working. He was a salad maker, so he had brought this nice salad to eat in his car that he had prepared himself at work. Now, that's one version. The other version that I saw was that he wasn't eating his lunch. He was sitting in his car masturbating. He's masturbating.
Probably what he was doing.
And again, either way, he's eating his lunch looking at his victim, or he's parked and he's masturbating, but he's looking at the victim. Now, what he doesn't know is that there's a police helicopter that's been checking out the area, surveilling the area, and they've not only seen him in his car, but they can also see the body, right? They know where the body is, and they can see him sitting there looking down at this body. And here's the other thing I don't understand, Gibbs, because so he may have been aroused at the idea of having sex with this body. I don't know how he was going to, because by everything I read, the river had frozen
right
by this time, because that's how they could see the body and that's how he was seeing it. It was actually frozen.
Yeah.
So I don't think he actually was going to. I think he was aroused by the thought of it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think he was masturbating, not eating a salad.
Well,
he might have been doing both.
Both.
So at one point, the helicopter gets closer and he realizes it's there and he takes off. But the helicopter's following him everywhere he goes.
You can't shake a helicopter.
Well, no. There's no. How are you going to get
away? You remember that year. You thought you could shake it.
Couldn't do it.
You couldn't do it. They found you.
So what the helicopter does is call in some patrol cars, and now they're following him. And where Shawcross goes is to where his wife works. And it's this adult home is how it was mentioned. And he goes inside. And the police go inside after him. And they ask somebody that's in an attendant working there. And they say that he went down to the basement. They find him in the basement. They ask for ID. And he actually gives them a photo ID. And he asks them what they want. So ultimately, he's interviewed in the car by one of the policemen. And it's actually a person that's on the task force. And they ask him why he'd been there on the bridge. And Shawcross's answer is that he had been out driving and he had to stop and urinate. But when he saw the helicopter, he decided to sit in his car and urinate in a bottle. That was his answer. Now, remember, we talked about in the beginning, this is not a smart man.
Mm-mm.
Right? His IQ was somewhere in the neighborhood of 80-something,
right,
if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So he was not super intelligent. So when they get him to the station, they start grilling him, obviously, for a number of hours about what he'd been doing that morning. And at first, he actually was able to convince them through whatever story he told them. And it was said that he was completely cooperative during the whole time. He answered every question. He even talked about, you know, his past wives, his past jobs, some of his sexual habits. And I guess he went into some detail about those and even talked about the attacks that he had gone to prison for on the two kids, or the murders. I shouldn't say attacks, but the murders that he had committed earlier. And the whole time he had not been placed under arrest. So he was actually under no obligation to talk at all. So they end up releasing him and he goes home. But they have him under constant surveillance. And it's just the next morning they pick him up again to go through what they called a few inconsistencies. And again, he was very compliant. But this time, Gibbs, they're a little more forceful maybe in their questioning. And they're grilling him pretty hard, talking about some of the prostitutes that he had seen. And it's really just later on that evening that Arthur Shawcross ends up identifying photographs of 11 victims, and he confesses to all of their murders.
Gave in pretty easy.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like he put up a lot of a fight. I mean, he voluntarily confessed. I mean, unless they were banging his head off the table or, you know, coercing him in some way that I'm not aware of.
They just got him excited if they banged his head off the table.
I mean, he even went as far as to accompany the police to all these different dump sites and show them where he had disposed of the bodies. You know, obviously the ones that they didn't know where the bodies were. And it was that night that he was officially charged with the Genesee River killings.
There were several of the prostitutes that were still missing. And they played on that, the interviewers. And they said, look, Art, there's girls out there that are missing that we know you killed.
They had a stack of photographs of the victims, like a bunch of playing cards.
He took the stack and like a deck of cards, dealt out the ones that he was responsible for.
And then they went back and talked to him about each one, and he gave a confession to each and every one.
Sounds pretty easy.
Yeah.
So because of that, obviously, there's a trial, but it's not a real long, drawn-out affair because he's confessed. So his trial begins in November of 1990. He's tried for 10 murders in Monroe County. Because you remember, one of them actually happened in a different county.
That would have been a trial. I wouldn't have mind seeing that.
I mean, that would be, it would be gory and it would be hard. I mean, kind of like us doing the research. Now, this trial was televised and apparently it drew unbelievable ratings. I don't remember it. So I don't know if it was televised nationally. I'm thinking it wasn't because.
Yeah, I think you're right.
This was pre-OJ. So in 1990, this was probably a local televised event.
Regional, if anything.
Yeah, regional. Probably shouldn't say local. Probably regional. Now, even though he confessed, he ended up pleading not guilty by reason of insanity. The prosecution, they had dissected his whole life because they had to be prepared to challenge this insanity plea. And it was said that they even went back to his school records all the way back to second grade. They got all of his records of military service. By the time that the trial started, the lead prosecutor said, "I probably knew more about Arthur Shawcross than he knew about himself." That's how confident and prepared they were for this trial. Now, he didn't testify, but what jurors were able to see was some videotapes which showed a series of interviews that were conducted with Arthur Shawcross under hypnosis by a defense psychiatrist. And it was said that in these tapes, in these interviews, he would switch in and out of a high-pitched woman's voice. So acting very strangely, whether he was playing it up to back up this insanity plea.
Yeah.
And at one point told the psychiatrist that in a former life, he had been a cannibal in medieval England.
Okay. Did he throw any baby talk in there too?
Not that I know of, but that would have been interesting. What he did do, and it was said it was in very, very graphic detail, is he went through the incestuous relationship that he had with his sister when he was young. He went through all the wartime Vietnam stuff that we talked about in part one, the cannibalism, all that stuff that he said happened in Vietnam. What was said to be probably have the most impact in this whole thing was a part of the tape or a part of the interview where Arthur Shawcross appeared to be reliving an episode in which he was sexually abused by his mom. And this was the point where he told the psychiatrist that it was his mother's voice that had told him to kill all of these victims.
Kind of reminds me of Psycho, Bates Motel.
Yeah. Maybe he got it from that.
Maybe.
I don't know. But it wasn't that just that she told him in a voice. He said that she actually helped him strangle and mutilate some of these women. Now, not physically, right? She wasn't there. So I don't know what he means by guiding him, guiding his hands to strangle or guiding his hands to mutilate. At one point in the tape, while he's under hypnosis, it was said that there were five distinct personalities that came out. One of them was his own mother. So he must have been talking in a voice as his mother. And then one was some strange man named Aramis. And then there was another man. I mean, none of these were people that anybody knew as far as I could tell. Now, famed FBI profiler Robert Ressler, who viewed the tapes, would come out and call all of this unbelievably outrageous and untrue. He didn't believe a word, or I shouldn't say a word. He didn't believe anything he saw or anything he heard. Now, he would also have some videotaped interviews with famed psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. And in those, he said he never heard voices. He never had different personalities. And so Dietz concluded that basically Shawcross was faking some type of mental illness to avoid being sent to prison. And I think that's pretty obvious from all the research that, we did, Gibbs, is that he was putting on a show.
Yeah.
To back up this insanity plea.
Absolutely is what he's doing.
So the jury deliberated for about 6 hours and they convicted Shawcross in late December of 1990. Now, a few months later, he was tried in Wayne County for Elizabeth Gibson's murder. But this time he didn't even bother with the insanity claim or the insanity defense. He just pled guilty and he got a life sentence for that. And I got to play this tape, Gibbs, and then we'll talk about it.
When I picked those women up, I thought I had AIDS. Because one of the women who stopped in the car told me one of the women I took out is HIV positive. I didn't know which one of them were, so I went back and picked up all the ones I dated in two streets in Rochester. And I started killing them. And while I was doing it, I took the vagina of three and ate it. Why? I don't know. Probably to speed up the idea of the AIDS disease.
So that's what I refer to as the AIDS defense.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that contradicts everything he said up to this point. So it just goes to show that you just can't believe a word that comes out of this guy's mouth.
He didn't know if he had AIDS. He thought because one of the girls had it, that he could have it. But he didn't know he had it. But so then he went, killed these ladies, and then went back and ate three of the vaginas to get the AIDS in the system faster is what he was thinking.
I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense, man.
None of what he says makes sense to me. So he got the life sentence for the murder of Elizabeth Gibson. What we forgot to mention was he got 250 years for the others, which is a little bit longer than life, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of like two and a half life sentences there.
But either way, this guy was never getting out. And he ended up going to the Sullivan Correctional Facility. And, you know, on a side note, I guess, July 10th, 1997, Art gets married for the umpteenth time. And he ends up marrying Clara Neal, the lady that he borrowed the car from to kill all these women.
So why would you marry a guy that killed?
Because you know she knows all of this.
Yeah.
It's no secret.
No.
There's no way he could have hid this from her. So Clara is 66 at this point. Arthur Shawcross is 52. And apparently they had started dating after he was arrested, but before he was convicted somehow. I'm telling you, this guy, he was able to get women to do things that baffle me.
Yeah.
But she had this quote that I have to read. She said, "It took me to 10 years to make the grade, but I finally made it." I mean, she was like glowing that she had finally snared the catch that was Arthur Shawcross.
She was the only one alive.
Maybe she was just so happy that he hadn't killed her.
Yeah.
No, I mean, just think about it, though. She was so happy. It took her 10 years, but she finally got him. That's how big of a catch Arthur Shawcross was.
She can have him.
And in a statement, Gibbs, she says that she loves Arthur Shawcross and that she stands by her cannibal no matter what. She literally called him a cannibal. Holy shnikes. So his wife before that, Rose, she had died in the spring, and that's what made it possible for him to marry Clara. So we got to talk about Arthur Shawcross, the painter, because to me, this was fascinating. So apparently they had this thing in prison where inmates could buy their own art supplies and they could keep half of the proceeds from any art that they sold. And the other half would go to the State Crime Victims Board. And in September of 99, Shawcross got 2 years in solitary confinement and he lost all of his art privileges for 5 years because he was having agents sell his paintings outside of the prison on eBay. So apparently he would mail the drawings and the oil paintings out to these people, these dealers. They would sell them and then they would send him a bunch of gifts. I guess they couldn't send him the actual cash, but they sent him, you know, clothes and supplies and shoes,
cigarettes and
stuff like that. Now they have that Son of Sam law, Gibbs, which basically says that you can't profit from the actual crimes that you commit. But prison officials said that this didn't violate that because what he was doing didn't have anything to do with the actual crimes.
So he didn't write a book about it. He didn't draw pictures of the victims.
I guess he only got in trouble because he was mailing them outside. Now, why in the hell they were letting him mail stuff outside?
I don't know.
But the one that got me is apparently he painted a portrait of Princess Diana. And it was that one and some other sketches and paintings that had been sold on eBay. And I guess they sold for like $500-$600 each. And there are people out there. There's a lot of people out there that collect serial killer memorabilia, I guess I'll call it, or anything connected to a certain serial killer.
What if we have any of those folks listening to us?
I mean, I don't doubt that we do. And I'm not saying it's something that's super strange.
It'd be interesting to talk to them.
I know you always want to talk to these serial killers.
Yeah, call and leave us a message.
All right, Gibbs. So we got to wrap it up. I just got a few more things. Arthur Shawcross, he died at age 63 in 2008. Nothing spectacular about it. He just died. He wasn't killed by another inmate, or he just complained of some pain that took him to the hospital and he died.
It's called being struck down.
But there are some interesting just tidbits about this. So the Arthur Shawcross case is cited as one of the first where the FBI's profiling unit helped catch the killer. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think even John Douglas may have been in on this one. He's, you know, probably one of the most famous FBI profilers. I think he was involved. But we talked about how they ultimately came up with this theory that the killer liked to revisit the bodies, and that was part of the whole profile that led them to catching him. So another interesting fact, Gibbs, is that Arthur Shawcross actually got 10 write-in votes in the 1990 New York governor election, or gubernatorial, I guess, if you want to be correct.
It's a bunch of sickos, man. Why would you even write him in?
Who would do that?
Why would you even give him any type of notoriety?
As a goof.
Yeah.
Now, a day after Dorothy Blackburn was murdered, there were two Rochester cops who stopped Arthur Shawcross while he was driving Clara Neal's car. He was given a ticket for driving without a license and for having two kids in the back seat that weren't restrained. These were two of Clara's kids. Now, what the cops failed to notice, apparently, is that the seats were all bloodstained. Because it's one thing we kind of haven't talked about, right? He killed some of these women inside Clara Neal's car. And how did she not know, or did she know?
I think she knew. She was just so enamored with him.
It could be. You actually could be right. But the thing is, so they didn't notice that. They didn't run his name through the computer. Because if they had, they would have found out that he was on parole for manslaughter. And we talked about the parole conditions in part one. One of them was that he was not to have any contact with any children under the age of 16.
Yeah, and here's two of them right behind him.
Right. That would have violated his parole immediately.
And they would have shipped him back.
And that would have meant that nobody after Dorothy, and you remember, she was one of the first ones, if not the first, all those murders that happened after her would never have happened. So the very last thing, so we talk about that. Right. They could have stopped him. But you have to go back to his light sentence for the murder of the two kids and his release. And you have to wonder why, because we talked about it, Gibbs, in part one. Remember, they had all those psychological evaluations that were basically saying this guy should never be let out. And they let him out anyway. And because of that, and because he probably should have gotten life for the two murders that he committed back then.
Should have.
I feel like the justice system kind of let down there. And 11 more people ended up losing their lives. I don't think you can overlook that. But I guess you can always look at scenarios like this, because there have been a lot of other people that have been paroled and have gone on to do bad things.
Sure.
And I guess you can always second guess a decision. But when you look back at all the facts, not even knowing what was going to happen, just look at what he did to those two kids. You would say that person probably should never walk the streets again. I think you could say that.
Easily.
And the fact that he did he spent time, but he was out way earlier than he should have. Oh. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right. So that was the case, the two-parter wrap up on Arthur Shawcross. Unbelievably nasty, nasty individual.
Absolutely. Terrible. Demented.
As Charles Barkley would say, terrible.
Terrible.
That man was terrible.
Terrible.
All right, guys, we're wrapping. So another episode of True Crime All the Time in the can. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.